We know that microbes have been around for way longer than complex eukaryotes have been. We humans have evolved in a background of both bacteria and virus and other microbes. So you can say we, as humans, quote unquote, assumed they were already there. So you can think of them as the extension of the human form in that sense.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization, also known as ISAP. In this podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And in today's episode, we've got quite an unusual setup that we have two guests, Nate Ritz and Thomas Bastiansen, and both of them are going to be talking about a recent study that they were involved in. So that's quite unusual as well. We normally don't restrict things to a single study, but we thought this one was particularly interesting. And let me give a disclaimer at the start, because I'm actually an author on the paper that we're going to be discussing, so I'm biased. Dan can look out for that bias and correct me when I overdo it. The paper itself involves the gut-brain axis. Nate, could you just give us some sense of what is the gut-brain axis and why would we be interested in that in general?
Yeah, of course. And first off, thank you both very much for having us on. We're really excited to be here and be able to discuss this exciting paper we got out. But yeah, so our paper focuses a lot on the role of the gut-brain axis, and in this case, in stress. But the gut-brain axis simply describes the bidirectional communication between the microbes and the gut with the brain and how it affects both the brain and behavior in terms of mood and emotional regulation. It's a fairly complex field. It's very systems biology oriented. The microbiota can communicate with the brain through the gut through numerous different modes of communication. Perhaps the best known is through the vagus nerve, but there's also the production of microbially derived metabolites, such as short-chain fatty acids. There's also endocrine signaling and the enteric nervous system, as well as the immune system. So there's a lot of different ways that the microbes in the gut can then, when they change in either their community organization or their functionality, that could then have far-reaching effects that can affect us in new ways that we're still discovering and working on today.
You guys have both done work that kind of helps explore the overlap we're seeing between functional GI disorders and stress and anxiety and other psychiatric conditions. Can you talk a little bit about that as a prelude to setting up the interesting work you did in the paper we're discussing today?
Sure. Yeah. So there are a lot of different ways that the microbiota can affect diseases and disorders of the host. We specifically are looking at diseases that are stress-related, so things like anxiety and depression, but they could have large effects. And of course, the microbiota has been involved in many different diseases and disorders now, some originating in the gut, such as irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel disease. But what we've really focused on at our lab and John Cryan's group is diseases that affect mood and behavior. So things like major depression disorder, general anxiety disorder. Another study that we've worked on is actually on social anxiety disorder. So we're really looking at these different type of mood-related disorders, but there's a lot of different work being done in the fields. I don't know, is there anything else that you'd like to add there, Thomas?
No, I think you summarized it really well. Obviously, the field of stress and stress resilience is extremely broad and complex and nuanced. And part of this field is the gut-brain axis in general, which is notably not the microbiome gut-brain axis, but just like the interaction between the body and the mind in general. And of course, the gut microbiome residing in the gut plays a major role in this in both sides of it. So if you go through a period of severe stress, your microbiome, your physiology will change, and with that, your microbiome might change. But the other way around, if you take, say, some antibiotics, your microbiome might take a hit, which will then impact your resilience to stress later.
And can I ask maybe an unfair question, but more of a philosophical question? Why would the brain care what microbes are in the gut and what they're doing?
So I want to flip that question around and say, why not? Because we know that microbes have been around for way longer than complex eukaryotes have been. We humans have evolved in a background of both bacteria and virus and other microbes. So you can say we, as humans, quote unquote, assumed they were already there. So you can think of them as the extension of the human form in a sense.
Yeah. So just kind of extending that point, I think it comes back to our evolutionary history where we've evolved alongside the microbes. So they have really become a pivotal point of our own health and well-being, where they produce a large range of metabolites and other products that we're actually unable to produce ourselves through our own diet, which has been a really foundational source using germ-free studies and animals that have no microbes and seeing what kinds of differences that we can find there. But essentially, the microbiota provides a lot of different functions that are really helpful to the host. So in our case, host being humans. But what we can see is that basically the different metabolites, immune function that the microbiome itself adds and confers, as well as different signaling of basic autonomic bodily physiology needs, whether it's gastrointestinal peristalsis and transit and motility to higher order things like brain, mood, and cognition. And a lot of times what you see in things that arise during sickness behavior is it originates in the gut, but then you'll also notice that you'll have headaches or not feel well mentally, not be able to focus as well. And a lot of times we disentangle these separate feelings, but in reality, they're all really tied together by what's happening in the gut.
And you've both worked, of course, with the wonderful John Cryan, who's maybe one of the world leaders, if not the world leader in this whole space. And, you know, it was, and I should put in a little advert here. John is going to be speaking at the ISAP annual meeting later this year. So ISAP attendees will get the benefit of listening to John firsthand. But the paper we want to talk about, and John has published, and you both published a series of really interesting papers, but the one we have to talk about today is titled, and I'm going to read it out here from the screen, "The Gut Virome is Associated with Stress-Induced Changes in Behavior and Immune Responses in Mice." There's a lot to unpick there. The virome. It starts with the words, the virome.
The vast majority of microbiome research to date has all been focusing on the bacterial portion of the microbiome, which we frequently call now the bacterial, which just refers to the bacteria themselves. However, there are multiple different kingdoms, divisions of microbes that live in the gut, from the viruses to fungi to archaea and protists. So when we look at only the bacterial, which does make the largest collection of microbes and the highest functionality of the gut, which is, I'm not saying not to look at the bacteria, I'm just saying that it's, to get the full picture, we have to see how they fit in the greater microbial community. So the virome itself refers to the collection of viruses in the gut, which is predominantly made up of bacteriophages. So we will see some eukaryotic viruses, things that can cause common cold or stuff like that. So you'll also see plant viruses. But again, the vast majority are actually bacteriophages, which I don't need to tell you, Colin, as one of the world experts in bacteriophage biology yourself. But essentially, these bacteriophages infect the bacteria in the gut, and they have a very interesting role in not only being able to infect and potentially kill different bacteria, but in the gut, what we see are predominantly temperate bacteriophages. So they could either infect and cause a lysis of bacterial cells, or they can infect and go into a lysogenic state or incorporate themselves into the bacterial host cells. And when that happens, interesting things can happen. They could later go on to a lytic conversion, or they could actually transfer different genes that confer different types of things like either antibiotic resistance, or they can increase their metabolic range. So there's a lot of interesting things that happen in these different phage-host interactions. So kind of unraveling this really complex interplay between the bacteriophages, whose hosts are the bacteria, whose host is us, the human, has kind of turned into this very complex ecosystem of having a superorganism or holobiont that contains all of this different microbial ecology inside of us. So the virome, again, just essentially refers to this viral portion, and that's what we were studying in this paper.
And Thomas, maybe you could comment on, I know your training really is a bioinformatician, can you comment on some of the difficulties of trying to work with the virome as opposed to working with the bacterial?
Oh, for sure. There's plenty of them. It starts even with that there is even discussion on how exactly should we define a virus, right? So there was even some radical biologists who don't consider it to be fully alive, or like there is already these characterizations and these classifications, they start to fall apart at this very small level. But for instance, it is hard to distinguish a bacteriophage from its host. A lot of its biology happens within, when it's integrated within the host, and it becomes, so these are oftentimes free floating or within a capsid units, or I want to call them organisms myself. So because they have such different structures, it can become very hard to fully capture all of them, to all of these capsids at a relatively similar time point, so that you can find them all, sequence them all, without maybe having a few of them still closed, so that you can never get to their DNA. They might not even have DNA. There's a lot of RNA. There's a lot of difference in the stability of these materials. So it's always going to be, you know, a shotgun approach where you see what you find. There is a lot of development that remains to be done in terms of the omics techniques to capture these guys.
So can you talk about how experimentally you would show the impacts of changes in the virome? I found it intriguing that you guys use fecal virome transplants. I know a lot of our listeners will be familiar with fecal microbiota transplants, but can you talk a little bit about the actual interventions you used in your experiments?
Yeah, absolutely. So great point to kind of shed some more light on. Fecal microbiota transplants have become very common in the field, originally for treating Clostridium difficile or Clostridioides difficile infections. And it kind of follows on that same line of thought. But what a lot of people don't really fully consider is that even fecal microbiota transplants, or FMTs, actually have a full collection of microorganisms. So again, we primarily think of the bacteria, but when you're doing an FMT, you'll transfer all of these different microbes as well. So again, the viruses, archaea, fungi, potentially protists as well. So what we were doing here is we wanted to separate out all of those other organisms and really just focus on the virome itself. So what we're calling that is a fecal virome transplant. That's something that Lorraine Draper helped me set up, and she's used in some of her previous studies as well. But what it essentially is that we remove all of the cellular organisms that are larger, and we remove all of the small particulate that is smaller than the phage. So we're really focusing on that one strata of size where the bacteriophages exist in the FMT. And after we separate them all out through a series of complex laboratory techniques, and then we reconcentrate them so that we have a high number of these phages, we could then use that, and that's what we're calling a fecal virome transplant, or FVT. And it provides a really interesting tool to use, because there have been different things called like phage therapy, where you use specific bacteriophages to treat a specific pathogen, and you try to create these cocktails that all target a specific pathogen and wipe them out. And there have actually been some really interesting anecdotal studies doing that. But we wanted to come at this at a more full microbiome angle and try to use a fecal virome transplant as a model where we're not just taking a single bacteriophage, but taking the entire phage population from healthy mice and then transfer it back to them while they're undergoing stress to try to modulate the bacterial portion of the microbiome and confer resilience to stress.
So this was an unusual setup, I guess, that you weren't transferring the virome essentially from, you know, one group of mice to another. You were giving the mice their own virome back, but after an intervention which would have disturbed their bacterium or their microbiome in general, I guess. Can you just describe the experimental setup? And I'm particularly interested in how you set about inducing stress in these animals.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And when you talk about that, can you, talk about how you guys cleverly showed that it's a two-way street, like stress causes alterations, alterations can mitigate the stress response?
Sure. No, absolutely. Both good points. So what we originally started off with this study was just to see if there was any difference following stress. So we used a chronic psychosocial stress model in mice, and basically we applied the stress to them, and then we measured the differences between healthy, non-stressed mice, and then mice that underwent this stressor. And then following the stress, we saw that there was differences both in the bacterial, but interestingly also in the virome, and specifically in different bacteriophages that we were able to measure. Correspondingly, we also saw differences in the behavior of the mice. They showed higher anxiety and depression-like behavior, as well as activation of their immune system. So that's kind of what the first starting point of this study was showing that there is a difference following stress between bacterium and virome and stress versus control animals.
And is there any evidence, Nate, sorry, before you go on to describe the second bit, is there any evidence that is replicated in humans, that humans undergoing stress, maybe people don't know so much about the virome, but does the bacterial change in people undergoing stressful events or life events or things like that? Thomas, maybe you can...
I can even go a little bit further, where we can see that the degree of change in the microbiome following stress, both in an animal model as well as in human participants, volunteers, we can see that the more stress they behave afterwards, or the more severe their personal stress response is, the more their microbiome has changed as well. So this is a metric we call volatility. So we can look at, of course, the ecosystem, all of our measurements are snapshots in time. They are sequencing, or they are some sort of capturing of a single point. But obviously, like any other ecosystem, the microbiome is in constant flux. And this degree of change can be quantified. And so what we see is that after following a stressor, the participants, but also mice undergoing a similar paradigm that the one Nate just described, the ones who display the most severe reactions to distress were those have the biggest changes in the microbiome.
That's really fascinating. And in humans, you might imagine that someone who's really stressed would change their diet or would, you know, be at home in bed under the covers or whatever the paradigm is. But for mice, of course, you're controlling for a lot of those factors, environment and diet, and yet you still see these same changes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Generally, when you're at your most stressed, you're taking the least best care of yourself. So there's definitely some links between the microbiome there. But even when we control all this in mice, we could still see differences just when stress is applied.
And I think that's why it's important to, you know, sometimes mouse studies, particularly in behavioral studies, they're dismissed a little bit because they say they're not humans and so on. But, you know, if you really want to explore mechanism, I think you have to be able to control for all these confounders. You can only really do that in preclinical models. But Nate, perhaps you go on and describe the second part of the experiment then. So you established that imposing the stress changes the murine behavior, changes their immune system, and changes their bacterial and virome. So what did you do then?
Right. So this is where we come back to the fecal virome transplant that we were talking about earlier. So we designed a similar experiment where we applied a similar stress, but then as a treatment, we used a fecal virome transplant. And this kind of goes on to the point that you were inferring about earlier, Colin. We used something called an autochthonous fecal virome transplant, which is it's an interesting word that I don't think a lot of people know, but it essentially refers to originating in the same area. Typically, people use it to talk about patients, but in this case, we're talking about the microbes. So these microbes started in the same area in that we took the fecal virome transplant from the same individual mice when they were healthy and happy, and we removed it, purified it, and then we started giving it back to them at the same time as they started undergoing the stress. So for each individual mouse, they received their own fecal virome transplant from an earlier time point, which on its own, it's like another side tangent. It kind of brings up the possibility of potentially in the future using biobanks as a way we could have personalized medicine. Some cases, your best microbiome match is indeed yourself from a earlier, healthier time. So it might be an interesting point for future discussion. But in the case of this study, we took them through the chronic social defeat model while giving them back their fecal virome transplant from the earlier time point. And then we measured their behavior across a few different classic neuroscience behavioral techniques, the social interaction test to test their social behavior, the elevated plus maze to test their general anxiety-like behavior, and then the forced home test to see their stress coping behavior as well. So after we took them through this, we were able to see that there were large restorations, specifically in different behaviors that are most associated with anxiety behavior. So their locomotor activity was improved. It first was reduced by stress. And then once we gave them a fecal virome transplant, they had more locomotor and exploratory behavior, which is frequently linked with anxiety-like behavior. So it's improved. We also saw differences in how much time they would go out on the specific arms of the elevated plus maze. So it's kind of this maze paradigm that's in the shape of a plus. And on two opposing sides, there are tall walls that the mice prefer to be in because it kind of gives them a feeling of security where they can hide back in the corners. And then there's two exposed arms that they have the option to explore at their will. And generally what you see is in more stressed and anxious mice, they spend more time in the confines of the walled parts of the maze. But then when they have less anxiety, they'll spend more time exploring these open arms where they can see that they're high up and see out across the room. And basically what we saw is that there was a reduction of this exploratory behavior, so higher anxiety, and mice that were stressed. And then after we gave them the fecal biofilm transplant, it was reversed.
Really fascinating. And the idea, I suppose, of depositing almost your virome somewhere. So, you know, especially if you knew you were going to have some kind of incredibly stressful event to, and then restore yourself afterwards. Probably, I just want to be ask you, Thomas, maybe, do you think that this impact of these bacteriophages, these bacterial viruses, you know, the viruses do not infect the mouse. They do not infect any mouse cells. So,
no.
Do you think that the viruses are interacting directly with the murine nervous system or enteric nervous system? Are their impact is entirely translated through the bacteria that they infect? Or do you know that yet?
I mean, it's a very good question. Like, obviously, first of all, we don't know yet. And we do know that, of course, these phages, they do contain bacterial genes on their own. So we can also look at viruses or phage, and even though they might not be inside of a bacterium, and even they might not practice translation or transcription themselves, they do contain the genes that are necessary for certain operations. But we also know that you don't need to be transcribing and translating to have an effect in the host, right? Like viruses have effects on the host all the time, even if they don't infect. They might activate the immune system directly. But I find it more likely that they do their thing through bacteria that they infect. And here I just want to shine a light on what I consider to be a real brilliance of this study. And I can confidently say this because I did not come up with it myself, so I'm very appreciative of it. Phage have this interesting work where they are extremely specific and specialized to their own host, right? The bacterial part of the microbiome can already be quite specific. But the phage part is extremely specific because they need a very specific host. They're extremely specialized and they might have been continuing with this same bacterial host for generations and generations. So simply transferring viruses or phage from one host to another, you're very likely going to find that almost none of them will ever bind because they're so different. They've never encountered this new environment. But by then transferring one's own virome, you completely solve this issue because you know all of these phage are already compatible with the bacteria that were there in the state where they were healthy still. But just to come back to your question, because of that, I do think it's likely that it's through the bacterium that they do direction.
Yeah, and there's some interesting studies. So conventionally, what we know is that bacteriophages don't interact much with the mammalian host themselves, but they do provide some very interesting different defense mechanisms. So one of them is called the BAM, or bacterial adherence to mucus mechanism, where you'll actually have bacteriophage lining the mucosal layer in the gut. And they can essentially be like within the wall where if bacteria get too close to the epithelial cells, the bacteriophage can serve as a potential defense mechanism that can either infect and lyse the cells or at least prevent them from getting there as easily. So what we think is that we don't see much bacteriophage direct interaction with the mammalian host and causing different types of immune activation because they're so focused on the bacteria side themselves. There was an interesting study where they actually found that bacteriophages could elicit an immune activation. This was in a IBD model, I believe. So there, it's not fully known yet exactly what types of bacteriophage host interactions are happening. But what we do know is that the bacteriophage are primed for infecting the bacterial hosts of these specific mouse guts, and that's where we expect to see the largest difference. Indeed, we did see differences in the bacteria, with some of them being restored by the fecal biofilm transplant, and some of them that were increased by stress had been reduced by the fecal biofilm transplant. So interesting stuff, but there's more mechanistic detail that certainly needs to be done.
Changing subjects a little bit, Thomas and Nate, I really admire the approaches you guys use to try to quantify changes in composition. And so both of you are involved, but Thomas was the first author on a paper introducing the concept of volatility. In this Nature paper, you guys used the same sort of underlying framework of the Aitchison distance on the centered log ratios of composition. But I wondered if, Thomas, if you'd like to talk a little bit about how you go about selecting an appropriate statistical measure, but also one that's well suited to the particular analysis because it's not too complicated. Like it respects the compositional nature of the data, but then it otherwise is allows you to use very familiar concepts like Euclidean distance and to characterize changes in composition.
Yeah, I thank you for that really good question. And I should probably preface this by saying that for any budding or aspiring or senior bioinformaticians out there, I've written a two-part guidebook review. If you look for my name and Bugs as features, maybe we can put it in the show notes. There's in both of these papers, it's two-part. There's a lot of supplementary material where I go through a detailed analysis where I talk about all of these. And I also talk about the CLR, the Central Gradient Transformation, in depth. But just to have in a nutshell summary, there was this guy, John Atkinson, who was active in the field of mathematical geology, which you can imagine is a very slow field, where he did a lot of exciting mathematical research on the compositions of rocks, minerals in this case. And he devised this whole tool of compositional data analysis. So unfortunately, these, as you can imagine, the field of mathematical geology is not the most, you know, sensational field there is. And therefore, a lot of these techniques have remained in this field for a long time. But in recent years, it has become clear that the types of measurements we use to measure both the microbiome or the bacterium and also the virome, they are confounded by these compositional effects that John Atkinson talks about. So he proposes the central Glacier transformation. I won't go into how it works, but in essence, what it does is it quote unquote solves most of the issues that if you didn't expect them, it will take care of most of them for you in the background. And then you can start using your own method that you would normally use, like in the Euclidean distance.
And just so the readers will know what we're talking about by compositional, like if there were three types of things and you knew that you had 40% of type A and 30% of type B, by definition, there has to be 30% of type C. Like there's constraints on relative frequency data. So if you're trying to characterize composition and you don't respect those constraints, you're going to fool yourself. And so you need to respect the fact that your data are compositional.
Yes. So you can very easily imagine it where your data is inherently negatively correlated with itself. So if one of your aspects goes up, the other ones all have to go down by necessity. And unfortunately, this is something people don't respect as much as they should. And there are some limits there as well.
And the only other thing I would say, Thomas, is I'll be interested in seeing your career as you grapple with the difference between the composition of the microbiome and functionally what the microbiome does. Now, some of our compositional measures would sort of prioritize equal distribution of different taxa, and whether or not some taxa should be considered good or not is a problem. So compositional measures are sort of inherently problematic.
That's a really good point. And I just want to give a shout out to the phylogenetic ILR. Catherine Lozapan has devised a few metrics called UNIFRAC or the UNIFRAC family, where the taxonomic relatedness of different microbes or viruses can be taken into account. And then you say, well, rather than treating every single microbe as being completely unique, well, these are all lactobacilli, and so therefore I will weigh them differently. This is unfortunately not a compositionally appropriate technique, but there is a variant of this called the phylogenetic ILR, which does take into account compositionality, but also still weighs based on taxonomic information. So there are ways to still do this. But indeed, another big limitation, of course, in compositionality would be that you never know your exact level. You don't know your actual abundances. And this is not information that you can actually work with in the compositional field. So there are plenty of limitations, for sure.
And I'm going to give the last word to you, Nate. Where do you think this research is leading? I mean, maybe we've touched on it already, but what do you think is next? What needs to be done next?
Yeah, no, I think that is the elephant in the room. Where do we go next with fecal virome transplants and this type of work? And I think it's largely a two-part answer. And the first part is hints that Dan brought up there, and something that I'm really becoming more interested in myself, and that is finding out what the exact function of the microbiome is and these different parameters. So composition is great. It's good to have a library of who's who and what's there, what they are. But what's important is what they're doing. So that's kind of what I've gone on into the next step. I'm really focusing on experimental molecular wet lab techniques on studying the role of the metabolic function of the microbiome and what that will transfer. And hopefully I'll be able to follow that up with some more phage stories in the future. But more specific to the fecal virome transplant story, while I really like this technique for being able to try to change as much as possible using a full fecal virome transplant with the entire bacteriophage assemblage being transferred to the guts of these mice to have as large of an effect as possible, it's still a relatively crude measure overall in how we use it. So I think as we move forward, we'll get more targeted ideas of which bacterial specific pathobiont species need to be changed, whether it's their function. Like sometimes you don't actually need to wipe out the bacterial population, you just have to change what they're doing. And you can do that in a variety of ways, from trying to supply them with better neighbors, have better microbial community that supports them so that they're not becoming pathogenic or causing inflammation. But you could also do it by trying to target them and either reducing their overall abundance or equipping the good microbes, whether that's with the substrates that they need to divide and produce helpful compounds to promote our own health and well-being, or just increase their overall number. So I think in the future, rather than using an entire fecal virus transplant, we'll get a microbiome readout where we can see what the specific members are that might be causing some of these problems, and then specifically target them. And we certainly can use bacteriophage again, but rather than using the entire population, use cocktails that are devised to specifically either enhance the good microbes or target and either remove or fix the bad ones.
Great answer. And I want to thank you both. And I think it's been fun for myself and Dan to talk to two people who I think are really on the upswing in your careers and are already making a big impact. But I'm, fascinated to see what future impact you both make in this field. So thank you for joining us, Dan.
Thank you. It's great to see great systems biologists and bioinformaticians like Nate and Thomas. And so very much good luck on your future. I'll be very much interested in seeing what you do. Colin and I will both be watching.
The International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, also known as ISAP, is a non-profit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. Follow along with our activities by searching for ISAP Science on your social media platform of choice or visit www.isapscience.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.